You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Go ahead.
My name is Kenneth McLean, and I'm here on behalf of the Smiths, who are both appellants and respondents in this matter. The court's familiar with this case. It's been here before. It was filed in 2003. I've been to trial twice in the case, to the Court of Appeals three times, and as I said, returning here. As I reflected upon this procedural history in preparation for this case, I happened upon some writings by a Canadian justice of the Alberta Supreme Court, of all things. You may ask why. I'm doing some work in Canada. And
you understand that the legislature of the state of Missouri said we cannot make any reference to any foreign laws.
Well, that's coming up. I mean, but the principle involved here is a common law principle that I think is helpful in terms of our thinking about this case.
The common law would be considered foreign as well.
That's right.
Go ahead.
She said, we've moved from being a society governed by the rule of law to being a society governed by the law of rules. We have become so completely seduced by the notion borrowed from the criminal law that process ensures justice that we have come to believe that process is justice. Yet to members of the public who find themselves mired for years in the civil justice system's process, process may be the obstacle of justice. Now, I reflected upon that when considering the 10-year procedural history of this case.
Very profound. Continue.
And I thought that it was too, Judge. But this case cries out for a resolution by this court on an expedited basis. We are asking you to affirm the Western District's finding that aggravating circumstances, punitive damages, have been sufficiently found in regard to...
We don't affirm the Court of Appeals. We deal with the trial court.
I know. This is on transfer, and so the same finding that the Western District made, we're asking this court to affirm in regard to the trial court case. But in our view, just as the Western District found, the $1.5 million verdict cannot stand, and we're asking the court to resolve that $1.5 million verdict in a couple of ways, which I'll get to in a second.
Are you aware of the case, I think it was Kaplan versus Mercantile Bank, where there was a similar issue about punitive damages, where a company dumped 291 dump trucks of PCB on this fellow's land. Then they, I think, went bankrupt. Mercantile Bank took over the company, or took over their claims, and they also took over the punitive damages claim. I mean, it relates to the RJR versus Brandon Williamson. How does that, are you aware of that case, or how it would affect?
Yes, I am, but I'm more particularly aware that there is no way for a company that merges or assumes the liabilities to avoid the punitive damages of its successor company. But importantly in this case was the fact that in the Smith 1 decision, the court remanded the case for a decision as to punitive damages in relation and in consideration of the opinion of the case. They said that the trial was to be held consistent with the opinion of Smith 1. The evidence in the Smith 1 case that were recited by Judge Ulrich were all related to Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company, and for good reason. The transaction, whether you call it a merger or whether you call it a consolidation, had occurred prior to the first case. And it was on RJR's motion that the only company that was going to be tried was Brown and Williamson. That motion was granted, and so the first jury only heard evidence about Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company. And so this is very much like the Pope versus Pope case that we cite in the opinion, where the Western District reversed on damages, remanded the case, and the trial court then said, well, there was an arbitration award before the last trial. And I'm going to grant summary judgment based upon that arbitration award.
Was there a timely objection to the evidence that you're complaining about?
Oh, yes, sir. And the Western District so found. We objected prior to the trial of the case. We objected at the time that the evidence began. We objected throughout the trial, and then again before closing arguments, at which time the court acknowledged that we had objected throughout, as did the defendant, and that they put on the record that we had preserved that that objection throughout the entire trial.
But was the objection as to relevance or as to the question of whether this exceeds the remand?
Well, it was both, Judge, and if you look at my objections, both objections were stated throughout. The reality is, as Judge Ahuja even says in the dissent, an objection as to beyond the scope of the mandate is a relevance objection on its face. And in regard to that, Judge Ahuja even says it would have been irrelevant because R.J. Reynolds had no relationship to the transaction. So in that regard, it was understood and it was made as to both throughout the case.
Okay. You understand they contend that it wasn't. They contend that a relevance objection wasn't made and that ought to decide the entire case.
Well, that's what they claim, of course. But the reality is that in the case, as it was understood, relevance objections were made. Scope of mandate objections were made. All were understood to be relating to the same issue. That is, R.J. Reynolds was a stranger to the transaction. They were out of the case under the law of the case because they had made a motion before the first trial to be excluded. And that was the basis upon which Judge Ulrich had ruled that, in fact, a trial would occur as to the parties that were presented, not on different evidence, but on the same evidence. And that's what we did scrupulously as to the first issue.
So even back when Ulrich was deciding the case, RJR had already bought Brown and Williamson, and so it's really basically the same case and flaw of the case.
That's exactly right. It was they had bought it before the first trial. They had moved before the first trial to exclude all reference by their motion, and that was granted. And Judge Ulrich then ruled on the evidence that was presented in the first trial, and the law of the case precludes consideration of R.J. Reynolds under any circumstance becoming an interloper in this case. Now, here's my suggestion in regard to this case. How do we determine what amount should be applied? Is there an easier way to do this than remanding it for a trial on damages again, which is the very least, I think, that should occur in this case? And my answer is found in 84.14, which gives you complete discretion to apply the rulings of various courts to achieve complete resolution of the case while it's here in front of you. In this case, you have a finding by the first jury of $20 million of damages against Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company based upon the very same evidence that Judge Ulrich said should be determinative of whether or not there was a strict liability aggravating circumstances claim. Now, he claimed that he couldn't determine which of the claims the jury had found upon, and so we had to retry that issue. But he said that all of the evidence relating to the two disallowed claims were relevant to the strict liability claim. Therefore, both juries making the determination of the $20 million in the first instance and strict liability aggravating circumstance have complete identity of the evidence they considered. And so you have, under 84.14, the ability to assess now whether or not that $20 million first verdict against Brown and Williamson comports with constitutional principles as announced by in State Farm versus Campbell. Now, we briefed that issue once before, and in fact, Judge Teitelman, you might remember, I'm sure you don't, but you suggested that would be an issue that maybe you should examine here, but you decided not to decide the issue. You remanded it again back, not disturbing the Western District's finding. But we briefed that issue as to whether or not the $20 million comported with State Farm versus Campbell.
I remember it was 10 times 2 million, so it was 20 million.
That's right. And you commented on that, and you suggested that maybe you ought to consider that. You didn't at that time, and therefore it remains an open issue if you want to consider it, because it has not been decided by any court. The Western District passed on it, and you passed on it. It remains a determination that has not yet been evaluated. Now, I suggest that the reason why this would make sense is, number one, It was a jury that only decided the question as to Brown and Williamson, and it was closer in time to the events that occurred that we're seeking to have punishment for. In addition, this was decided 1 month before the caps as to punitive damages went into effect. And therefore, it avoids any question about what law should apply to this punitive damage finding. And then finally, this would avoid any concern or question that, again, we would have bleed in from R.J. Reynolds in regard to their ownership of the transaction. And, of course, it would be fair because Brown and Williamson bought the company knowing that they had a $20 million punitive verdict sitting out there. In fact, they factored this into their calculation when buying the company. And so if, in fact, the court were to order, this court were to order, briefing on the issue of the constitutionality, we've already briefed it once, we could get those in front of you quickly, and you could order argument on it, or you could remand this for the Western District to consider, and then it come back to you on some review should you choose to do it. Now, there's one last issue that I'm going to spend the less probably than the 1 minute I've got left on, and that's the jury, a misconduct issue that we raised in the Court of Appeals. The court made short shrift of that, but he clearly didn't disclose the fact that his mother had a lung disease. He was heard to say throughout the case that it was frivolous, even though we asked that question in voir dire. And his explanation about why he was heard to say these things strained credulity, as the cases say, because he said, I forgot that my mother was sick, and I didn't really remember that she was a smoker. That explanation didn't really hold much water. And so, at the very least, a new trial should have been ordered on that basis, but more importantly, we think that the way that this case should proceed is for you to review the original $20 million, but at the bare minimum, to remand it for a new trial on damages alone, leaving intact the finding as to punitive damages if, in fact, you decline to do this. I thank you so much for your
for 3 minutes rebuttal.
Consideration.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We've briefed a number of issues, including why we think this case should be at an end as well, but because we should get judgment as a matter of law. But in the limited time that I have this morning, I'd like to respond to the argument that Mr. McClain just made and to Your Honor's questions about why I think there was no violation of the mandate here and why, in any event, the issue isn't preserved. Let me start with why there wasn't a violation. I do think it wasn't preserved, but I want to make clear that I'm not trying to raise a preservation issue in order to avoid the merits of the issue. I don't think the issue on its merits has any merit. That's because you just heard Mr. McClain say that all of the evidence discussed in the Court of Appeals opinion the first time around related to Brown and Williamson. Well, the reason for that is the only evidence the Court of Appeals discussed in its opinion was the evidence presented at phase one of the first trial. The Court of Appeals explicitly decided that it didn't need, and understandably and correctly, that it didn't need to reach any of the issues we had raised about phase two, the amount phase, from the first trial. The Court of Appeals only discussed phase one. So there is literally zero in the opinion, not one word in the opinion, that addresses what happened at phase two the first time around or what should happen at phase two the second time around, if there was even going to be a phase two on remand, because maybe we were going to win at phase one and there wouldn't even be a phase two. So there is simply no mandate of the Court of Appeals on point. On point meaning what evidence should come in or not come in phase two on remand if the case got that far on remand. The Court of Appeals didn't address any issue about phase two. And that's why really what this is the trial court left to play the normal role the trial court plays, exercising its broad discretion over what evidence is relevant, what evidence is otherwise admissible, disposing of points that were not disposed of by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals could have addressed phase two. It didn't. It left phase two completely alone for the trial court to address in the first instance. And that's why we think this really is just a relevance issue, because there's no mandate on point. And of course, at the trial court in the second trial, there were various times where the plaintiffs objected to evidence relating to RJR on relevance grounds, but the plaintiffs haven't made any relevance argument on appeal. The only issue they've preserved on appeal, the only issue they've raised on appeal, we don't think it's preserved, the only issue they've even tried to raise on appeal is that admission of that evidence violated the mandate. That's the distinction between relevancy and the violation of the mandate that the Court of Appeals in the en banc decision, Judge Ahuja in his dissent explained. But the relevance of that distinction is just that the reason that I would submit that I think the plaintiffs are trying to reframe this issue as not about the trial court's control over the admission of evidence and relevancy and admissibility, but rather as something about the mandate, is because the plaintiffs did not adequately preserve an objection to this issue. And if this issue were considered as a normal issue about the admission of evidence at trial, such that the normal rules about how you have to preserve an objection to the admission of evidence applied, then it would be clear that the plaintiffs haven't preserved that, because they themselves presented evidence about R.J. Reynolds before we ever had the opportunity to do so. So under Anderson and Bowles and Mickel and Carollo and Peters and Bouchon and any number of other cases, I mean, the cases are legion on this, and they're unanimous. A party can't complain on appeal about the admission of evidence that the party itself presented. If the party presented the evidence preemptively as part of a trial strategy responding to a ruling on a motion in limine, that may have been an understandable trial strategy. That's what a lot of those cases say. But you have to pick your horse that you're going to ride, and you can't have it both ways. If the plaintiffs had really thought they were correct that evidence about R.J. Reynolds should not come in at phase two on remand, the cases say their remedy was to stand on that objection, to not rely on the motion in limine ruling, because the cases of this court, like Purley and many others, are equally legion, making clear that a motion in limine ruling doesn't definitively resolve anything, a motion in limine doesn't preserve anything, that the real event is what happens at trial, not at the motion in limine. So yes, there was a motion in limine ruling before the second trial that said that evidence, that new evidence could come in at phase two, but that didn't definitively resolve anything. The plaintiff's remedy under the cases was to wait until we tried to present evidence about R.J. Reynolds, object on all the appropriate grounds they wanted to raise. If that objection was overruled and the evidence came in, then the plaintiffs would be able to stand on that and have an appeal. And maybe even they would have been able to try something in rebuttal if the evidence had come in first by us. But what the cases make perfectly clear is you can't present evidence preemptively yourself and then complain that it came in. That's exactly what happened here. We had never presented any evidence about R.J. Reynolds in the second trial in either phase, and the plaintiffs made it a feature of their case in phase two. In the opening statement in phase two, actually even before phase two started, at the end of phase one in closing, the plaintiff's counsel said, we want you to the jury, we want you to come back and learn about what's going on today with RJR, the new owners. And then in phase two opening, the plaintiff said that this is about how to punish and deter Brown and Williamson and the new company, R.J. Reynolds, one page into their closing. And then the rest of the closing was about how there were reasons to be concerned that R.J. Reynolds was engaging in misconduct, so that on the merits of our defense in mitigation of punitive damages, that we were wrong, that R.J. Reynolds was just the same as Brown and Williamson, it was just as bad, and there was just as much need to punish and deter now that any conduct that could be deterred going forward would be conduct by R.J. Reynolds, not Brown and Williamson. I mean, that, by the way, I think it's important to make clear, that's not in dispute. The transaction here occurred in 2004. What this case is about at this point is design defect theory for strict liability product defect theory for Cool cigarettes. Well, Brown and Williamson hasn't made or designed Cool cigarettes since 2004 or any other cigarettes. Any conduct that can be deterred in the future with respect to how Cool cigarettes or any other cigarette should be designed or manufactured, that's not Brown and Williamson conduct, because Brown and Williamson is not in that business anymore. That's not disputed. That's why we thought that evidence about R.J. Reynolds was relevant in mitigation of punitive damages under Ma, under the Clorox case from the Sixth Circuit, Drayton, and under Burnett from this court, that evidence in mitigation that occurred after the relevant conduct for liability purposes is relevant to the calculus the jury is supposed to engage in for punishment and especially for deterrence. But in any event, then in phase two, the plaintiffs presented evidence about R.J. Reynolds as the key part of their case. They put on Dr. Burns and Dr. Wigand to talk about R.J. Reynolds' supposed bad conduct post-dating the events relevant to Mrs. Smith, and they put on Dr. Ward to talk about R.J. Reynolds' financial information. And yes, at various times during this, plaintiff's counsel stood up outside the presence of the jury and said, I want to make clear we preserve our objection. But the point of the cases is you can't do that. It doesn't matter if you say you want to have it both ways. You still can't have it both ways. You can't object to evidence that you yourselves present preemptively. And if you say you're objecting to it, it doesn't matter. You still can't do that. And what the Court of Appeals majority relied on in the en banc decision is a colloquy at page 3320, right before the closing of phase two, where the Court of Appeals majority said that we stipulated that the plaintiffs had preserved this issue. That, it's a short colloquy, and I hope Your Honors read the entire thing in context, because in context, it's very clear what was going on there. This was right before closing arguments in Phase 2. The evidence had come in. First, at the plaintiff's instance, they presented it in Phase 2. It had come in. We presented some, too. So the evidence was in the record. There's no issue that once evidence is in the record, it's been admitted, whether rightly or wrongly, it's in the record, you're allowed to talk about it in closing argument. That's exactly the point the plaintiffs were trying to make in context. They argued about a decision from this court called Newton from 2009, and they handed that up to the trial judge and said, we want to make clear before the closing argument that since the evidence has come in, we're going to talk about it during closing. In doing so, we maintain our position that it shouldn't have come in the first place. And we don't want to stand up repeatedly and object during your closing when you talk about this evidence, and we want to maintain our objection without having to do that to interrupt closing argument. And that's what Newton said. Newton said once the evidence came in, whether rightly or wrongly, whether accidentally in that case or whether on purpose, if the evidence is in the record, then you can talk about it during closing argument. That's what we said. We said we'll stipulate to the preservation of that objection, meaning the objection that during closing argument, if we talk about evidence about R.J. Reynolds, you object to our talking about it during closing argument. But that's beside the point, Your Honor. The reason that the plaintiffs waived this issue is not because they didn't stand up and object during our closing argument in Phase 2. The waiver occurred long before that. It occurred when they presented the evidence during Phase 2 themselves, preemptively. And at that point, the evidence was in the record, and we agreed that they could talk about it during closing argument. That's the stipulation.
Is this an argument you made to the trial court as well? When they made their objections at all the various times they made them, did you say they opened the door?
Your Honor, the issue about Anderson and Bowles and Mickle and preservation never came up as such during the trial. That's because even though the plaintiffs are citing a few parts of the record, pages 59 and 60 and 2755 and 3320, those are the only four places they cite, to say that they were granted a continuing objection of some sort so that they could present this evidence while objecting to it. The trial judge never said that. The trial judge said at 2755, you can have a continuing objection during Mr. Figler's testimony. Mr. Figler was one of our witnesses in phase two who talked about R.J. Reynolds' conduct. And so that the plaintiffs didn't have to stand up every time Mr. Figler testified about R.J. Reynolds, they said, can we have a continuing objection? I don't think we disagreed with the granting of a continuing objection. But at that point, again, the damage had already been done because the plaintiffs had presented the evidence themselves. The plaintiffs never asked the trial judge to rule that they could simultaneously present the evidence themselves and object to the evidence's presentation. The trial judge never ruled on that. So the issue never was litigated as such.
Break it down in smaller bites for me. Did they object to the relevance of your introducing evidence of RJR in pursuit of the argument that there was no deterrent value here against RJR?
At certain times in the second trial, yes, Your Honor, they did.
And when they made that argument, did you say, Your Honor, they've already introduced the evidence of RJR, the door's been opened?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that we said that in so many words, but the trial court made a ruling that the evidence was coming in. And there were maybe bits of the evidence that they presented or we presented where there was a different issue about admissibility, hearsay or I don't know, some other issue where there had to be an actual objection and a ruling. But the scope ruling that the trial judge made that evidence about R.J. Reynolds could come in was clear, and the trial judge adhered to it. And so that issue didn't really get litigated as such during the trial. But I would submit that there's nothing unusual about that. It's not for the trial court to decide what one party can raise on appeal. That's for the appellate court to decide. The trial court at most said you have a continuing objection during Mr. Figler's testimony, which is really neither here nor there because they had already put the evidence in themselves before Figler ever took the stand. And the trial judge never said, I'm going to let you have it both ways. I've read Anderson and Mickles and Bowles, and I think this is distinguishable somehow, and I'm under these circumstances, I'm going to let you put in this evidence and maintain your objection that the evidence never should have come in. The trial judge never said that. They never asked the trial judge to make that kind of a ruling. And so we never had occasion to tell the trial judge, no, that would be wrong, because they never asked for that kind of a ruling. So the issue is for the appellate court to decide, as it normally is, whether the issue was adequately preserved in the trial court or not. It wasn't for the trial court to prejudge whether the issue would be preserved on appeal. The trial court didn't purport to do so. In the little time that I have left, I want to respond briefly to what Mr. McClain said about remedies. For the reasons I've just said, we think this case should be at an end. We think that no error occurred, at least no error that was preserved occurred in Phase 2, and the result of Phase 2 is a substantial punitive damages award that should be affirmed, and this case should be over if this court disagrees with the arguments we've made in our briefs for why we should get judgment as a matter of law. If this court disagrees with me and thinks that this case has to be remanded, I don't think that this court has the proper authority to do what Mr. McClain has asked for a couple of reasons. First, the $20 million punitives judgment, punitives verdict from the first trial was based on all of the plaintiff's three claims, three non-intentional tort claims combined: negligent design, failure to warn, and strict liability product defect. They were all given to the jury in a single verdict director. As the Court of Appeals held in the first appeal, and as the en banc Court of Appeals said twice in its opinion before transfer, there is no way to determine what part, if any, of the $20 million was attributable to strict liability product defect. And there is no way that anyone can reconstruct that and try to figure out the answer to that question now. This court can't do that. The suggestion that this court should remand for the Court of Appeals or the trial court to do that doesn't work either. There's simply no way for anybody to figure out the answer to that question. That was the way the verdict director read, and the consequences of that are that decision, that verdict was set aside because of the reasons the Court of Appeals said, and that verdict no longer exists. It can't be reinstated, and there's no way to figure out how much of it was attributable to strict liability product defect. It's also not true that the Court of Appeals said in the first appeal that all of the evidence relevant to negligent failure to warn and negligent design was also relevant to strict liability product defect, such that it doesn't really matter and you can just take all three of those claims together. If that were the case, then the Court of Appeals presumably wouldn't have had to issue the relief that it did and vacate the verdict on account of the fact that you couldn't tell which claim the verdict was attributable to, and only one of the three was submissible. For that matter, if the three claims were interchangeable, then all three presumably would have been submissible, not only the one. So that doesn't work. Finally, Your Honors, the suggestion that as a fallback to reinstating the $20 million, that the right remedy would be a new trial limited only to the amount of punitive damages doesn't work either, because there's a statute specifically on point, 510.263.3, that says how punitive damages are supposed to be litigated. And it makes crystal clear by its plain language that the same jury is supposed to decide eligibility or entitlement to punitives and amount. And when the Court of Appeals majority in the en banc decision ordered that relief, ordered a new trial limited to amount, it didn't address that statute. It didn't explain the propriety of that relief. That's because the plaintiffs had never raised that relief. They never requested that relief in their briefs. It came up for the first time at oral argument. So the Court of Appeals didn't address 510.263.3, which makes perfectly clear that you can't do that. You can't have a new trial only on amount of punitives. The only case the plaintiffs can find that has ordered a new trial limited to the amount of punitives is McCraney. But the only case that McCraney relies on for that, for being able to do that, is this court's decision in Burnett. McCraney misconstrues Burnett. Burnett granted a new trial on the entire issue of punitives, both entitlement and amount. That's what the Court of Appeals did the first time around. That's what any new trial here would have to look like to be consistent with the statute. McCraney, maybe because the parties didn't raise it there either, didn't address the statute, and for reasons that it didn't explain, ordered a new trial limited to amount, but it didn't explain why that was appropriate. It's clearly not appropriate under the plain language of the statute. So I see that I'm over my time. Thank you, Your Honors, for allowing me this.
Thank you for being
extra time.
Our court. You did an excellent job. Thank you very much. What about that last point about you can't separate them?
Well, I think very clearly that you can. Judge Fisher's decision in Brad Ammon, I think is the way that you pronounce it, just recently decided, illustrates the point that you can separate damages from liability. And in his case, they left intact the issue of punitive damages and went back and tried the compensatory damages, even though we all know you can't have punitives without compensatories. And so the principle of 84-14 works for this court to fashion a remedy so that you're not retrying cases over and over and over again, and which time I'm sure that we'll be back again with claimed error.
Counselor, let me ask a question about, does this case present what looks like the reverse of the Newton case? In other words, in the Newton case, the plaintiff lost on his motion in limine. The defendant accidentally introduced evidence that the trial judge said he was going to keep out, and then since it was in for all purposes. That was the decision of this court. In this case, you lost the motion in limine, so you preemptively, at least according to opposing counsel, you preemptively went ahead and brought in evidence of R.J. Reynolds?
Counsel hasn't examined the record very closely, I'm afraid, on this point or several others. In this regard, I was adamant that this was error. I told the court over and over again, this is absolute error to interject this. And for the first phase, no one introduced any evidence about R.J. Reynolds. But knowing that the court had ruled as it did and that they were going to be allowed to discuss R.J. Reynolds, I specifically approached the bench at that time to say, because of your ruling, I am forced to address this evidence in this case. You can't wait till rebuttal.
What did the trial court say in response
Your objection is preserved, and counsel stipulated that my objection was preserved and that I was not waiving anything by living within the boundaries that the court had set for what the trial was going to look like.
Now, counsel, are you talking about before closing now, or are you talking about beginning or before the beginning of phase two?
Before the beginning of phase two, we again raised this issue.
Okay, but what was the discussion at that point?
Because the discussion at that point was is that we weren't waiving anything by talking about R.J. Reynolds before we ever did it. And counsel agreed to that. There was no objection to preserving that objection throughout. And nothing else would have made sense. How could you have proceeded to object to all the same evidence?
Time out. You could have just not introduced it.
Absolutely.
And then the record would be clear for us.
It sure would. And then I would have lost even bigger. And then you would have said you waived your opportunity because the court ruled. I mean, I'm in between a rock and a hard place here. I don't have any specific right to rebuttal. That's in the discretion of the trial court. I recently got trapped by that in the Western District by relying upon the trial court for telling me I was going to get rebuttal and not introducing it in my case in chief. And then the court decided I didn't have the right. So it was completely in the court's discretion. I don't have the ability to wait until rebuttal to put on evidence that I know is in contest and that the court has ruled specifically is going to be in the case. But I want to address the point that counsel raised with you where he said, the opinion doesn't say anything about second phase issues. Look at page 822 in Judge Ulrich's opinion. That begins the strict liability product defect discussion in the published opinion. Now, before this, he's already discussed the evidence that was submitted on negligent and on negligent design and negligent failure to warn. And specifically, he then rules that that wasn't enough on those two counts, but in addition to the evidence discussed above, the following evidence was presented pertaining to this conduct being tantamount to intentional wrongdoing relating to the strict liability product defect. And then he goes on to outline all of the other conduct that was in as regard to the strict liability claim. And therefore, it's upon all of that evidence that he relies to say we made a sufficient case as to strict liability product defect, and it had to be tried again so that the jury could make a specific finding as to that, as opposed to the other two counts, which he found insufficient evidence on.
But was there evidence that was excluded at the second trial that was admitted on the one of the other two counts on the first trial?
No, none. It all came in based upon this exact language that I'm reading to you, Judge Wilson, and I again cite to you 822. In addition to the evidence discussed supra, the following evidence was presented pertaining to this conduct being tantamount to intentional wrongdoing. So in other words, what Judge Ulrich was saying is that all of that evidence was relevant to the strict product liability claim, at least by the interpretation of Judge Roldan, and so it all came in the second trial. And that's why I say there is a perfect identity of the issues decided by those two juries and addressing, I know I'm over my time, but addressing this point in regard to the punitive statute. When it speaks of one jury, it's talking about the jury that decided compensatories. And that's an additional reason to consider the $20 million verdict, because the same jury that considered compensatories also made the determination in regard to the $20 million verdict. That's what it means when it says the jury. The decision made by the jury involves the first jury that made the compensatory judgment making the judgment in regard to the punitives later. In this case, you have that determination. The only injection is the determination to be sure that that in fact strict products liability aggravating circumstance had been properly found by the second jury. But that's the law of this case already. Thank you so much.
Any more questions? None of you have any more questions? Okay. Thank you. The case will be taken under submission.